Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's July 7th, 2019, and welcome to episode 195 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever...
Here's the Air is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and desert islands and no email for a year, or whatever. We'll get to that. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by several roundtablers. First, we are joined again by Michael Mulhern in Australia. How are you doing?
I've had better lifetimes, but I'm getting there, so I'm back in the land of the living, and looking forward to getting back into podcasting.
Excellent. Well, glad to have you back. Moving over to Sweden, this is a very international podcast we have today. Jack Nutting, how are you?
Hello. I'm pretty good. I with the exception of just old age, like my...
I should stop asking how are you now.
I'm not gonna go into it all in detail, but... My right calf is hurting.
Oh, be quiet, child.
All right. Well, moving on to Canada, we are joined by Carrington Vanston. How are you?
I'm falling apart. No, I'm kidding. I'm doing well. I guess that I've got a whole new perspective, so I think I'm doing amazing.
Excellent.
Oh, except I poked myself in the eye with a stick. So I got that going for me. About 2 hours ago, I leaned into a bush, and you'd think I'd see it coming because it's literally at the thing I see out of, but nope, right in the old eye. So I come to you from Canada all blinky and teary-eyed.
Just another one-eyed Apple fan.
Yep. Well, yeah, I guess I feel relatively okay. No air conditioner, but and the summer's on its way here, but... Yeah, our air conditioner sort of conked out at the end of last summer, and, you know, the summer was over, so then you don't do anything about it until it's already too late. So, no.
Oops.
All right. So, today, the host topic that we have decided upon is, we are calling it Desert Island Computer. And so, the setup is, if you had to use a single retro computer exclusively for a full year as your only computer at home, what would you choose? And I'm not sure what I will choose, but fortunately I am host and I can pass this first one off to someone else. So, Carrington, you said you chose one already.
Mm-hmm. I have a quick question though, which kind of informs my choice, seeing what the rules are here. So this would be my only computer I have access to at home for a year. Do I still get to have like my phone? Does the iPad count as a computer? Do I get those things too? Or is this it for like computational things in my house? What's the rule?
That is a good question. It seems like it would be almost impossible to just not be retired if you aren't allowed to have, you know, anything but what you pick.
Well, I can still have a computer at work.
Does the desert island have mobile coverage?
Oh, see, these are all very good questions. Are you allowed an abacus? Can you have a slide rule?
Well, okay, assuming that... you know what? I'm just going to go with my first choice then. My first choice, I don't know if this is my actual first choice, but the first thing that occurred to me was to, if you're going to have one thing and that's it for the year, you might as well just go huge. I mean, like just go big, just dream large. And so I selected the Sage. So the Sage is the semi-automatic ground environment. It was by IBM. It weighs 2 tons, takes 2 full floors of its own building, and requires 3 megawatts of power to run. It doesn't have internet access, but it does have radar dishes and its own ballistic missile system under its control. So that's pretty cool. So I can make other people pay for those 3 megawatts. I could like basically have a year in which I maybe enact a coup. So this was the first thing that occurred to me. If I'm going to go big, why not just go like massively huge and a computer that controls missiles? It was a dual CPU computer. So those 3 megawatts were just to run the single CPU. The CPUs in this thing are about 50 feet by 150 feet. So that's kind of cool. Each of them, and there's two, one always runs and one's in backup just in case, because when you have a missile system, you want to make sure you've always got computational power. So if I was going to go massive and explore like a weird computer, I would pick that one, like come home to my missile computer. But if it's going to be like a regular retro computer, I almost certainly would go super small. That whole minimalist thing. So I would want a computer that gives me multiple platforms because I like to cheat rather than just pick a single thing. So I almost certainly would go for something that like one of my beloved old vintage Macs that can take an Apple IIe card, give me that dual platform thing. So probably I would, less surprisingly, pick the LC475 because that would give me a vintage Mac. I could play a lot of System 7 and System 6 era games and also give me an Apple II. Unless I want to spend the year playing later 90s games, in which case I would go for a Power Mac G4, but not the mirrored drive version because it's a little loud. So a Quicksilver or a digital audio version, something like that. So I would go, in all seriousness, vintage Mac and probably an LC475. Mm-hmm. And I would just give up email for the year, and I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, although you could probably swing it with that.
Yeah, and I have email at work or whatever, like if I needed to. But if I had to go like just one computer at home and I was retired or whatever, just going to do it as an experiment, I had seriously considered like a toaster Mac, like a go black and white or something like that. I probably would have more fun with the Power Mac G4 and just boot into 9 or whatever, and gives you a lot of classic games, a lot of CD-ROM games. I could spend a year playing 90s era CD-ROM games perfectly comfortably. So either of those options would be happy for me, but I think I'm going to come down on the side of the LC475, so it gives me a 2E card because I do love me some 2E gaming.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Very nice. Jack, what do you think?
Well, I mean, yeah, if we can go as new as like the Power Max, then maybe, but I guess I feel like that's cheating because those were running Mac OS
like
10. That's still a current operating system. It's like, So I think I'm going to go older. I think I'm going to, and I'm going to say, though, an Amiga. Uh-huh. Probably an Amiga 2000 with a nice internal drive and maybe a better CPU card.
2000 is only 19 years ago.
I mean, I used it for years. It was a nice functioning multitasking environment. You can definitely do email. You can do networking. You can do all kinds of stuff. There's probably not a great web browser on an old Amiga, but there's probably something, actually. And amazing games, and that's what I would go for.
Yeah.
That's my home choice.
Of course, that's one problem with letting everybody go first. But, yeah, I was also thinking something like that, too. But one addition I might put on there is that you can get this, I forget what it's called, AMAX or something like that, I think it's called, which is essentially a Mac emulator that you can stick on your Amiga. So it can actually also run Mac stuff.
Yeah, that's true. All you need is you need the like the ROM chips out of an old Mac. You stick those in there.
Well, I know where there's an LC475 that you could steal the ROMs out of.
I want to go back to my missile system.
Yeah. Michael, do you have an idea?
Yes. Well, I was sort of maybe taking the desert island as a bit more of a location than a metaphor. So I was thinking along the lines of a Apple IIe clone. As much as I love my 2C, for this little project, I need to be able to pop the top off and play with it. And I'm also going to assume that it's all my old X10 stuff is there as well, because obviously we've got a power supply to run the computer. So there must be other stuff on the island, so I can control that with my X10 system. Plenty of games and plenty of educational software, so the natives could be introduced to our Lord God Loki, and I could educate them. And yeah, we'd have a rollicking good old time. And there's a couple of good MP3 cards for the Apple II, so you know, lots of media to play those MP3s. But we can even manage that at a stretch, and I'd be quite happy to forego the email for 12 months. But, yeah, I think I'd rock it with a Apple IIe clone and automate the island. Itch your heart out, Professor. No coconuts for me.
Well, and one thing that's nice about the Apple IIe, if you're actually going to be on an island, is that they're fairly sturdy. Like, they're pretty easy to fix. They have, you know, I was going to say they have pretty standard components, but I suppose that doesn't even
really
matter.
I'll just nip over to the other island next door and steal some stuff out of theirs, and then they'll truly be lost.
Lots of sunshine if you need to retrobrite it.
That's right.
Oh, no retrobriting. Evil.
But yeah, I think probably, so I should not pick the Apple III, because what'll happen is, like, in week two it'll stop working and that'll be it.
It's just trying to drop it into the sand. It does nothing.
Well, gosh, I don't know. I bet I could predict that Earl would say the Commodore 128. And I know I sort of thought about that as a possibility because of its CPU nature.
You could
nature.
Go Commodore 128, and then that would mean Earl would have to come up with something.
That's true.
Yes, you've stolen Earl his Commodore.
Maybe that's why.
Can he keep up with your Commodore that you're running out of his house with?
I mean, you know, so the thing that came to mind first, it really feels like a cheat. I can't quite decide if it's a cheat or not, because it seems like it's actually older but feels newer than the Mac. But what I was thinking is obviously by now a Next unit, because that's super familiar. You know, I could do anything I wanted to on it, but is it too new?
Why didn't I think of that?
How is it too?
Well, when you get lonely on the island, you have that wave or whatever, right. An email from Steve Jobs saying hello to you. So that's your Wilson.
Yep.
Punch out the monitor.
So I think maybe I'll stick with that. The next slab's nice and flat. I can, you know, put my coconuts on it or whatever. Fine.
Use it as a cutting surface.
That's right.
I was thinking the next cube, you could actually use the corner of it to smash open the coconuts.
Once.
Well, that's about how many times it'd take to break the coconut. God, those things are savagely pointy.
Oh, really? The next cube is something that I still would kind of like, but not. I don't, you know, like, I like the money that it costs more than I like the object. So
you're more of a slab guy.
Well, they're just very expensive. All right. Well, okay. So I think we're pretty well set. We can, you know, as long as we have our phones or our coffee shops or we are retired or whatever, then I think we can handle this year.
Thing is, I could see me eventually doing that. I use my iPad for more and more stuff. One of the primary things I use a computer for at home is podcasting, because I just don't have a good iPad podcasting / editing setup. But if I had that, I would strongly consider just having a phone, an iPad, and a retro computer. And, like, just, I could do email and Twitter and all that kind of stuff on my phone. That's what I mostly use it for nowadays. So I would happily just have a single or maybe two old computers, and that's it. No modern computer at all. I might actually do this.
I'm imagining, like, you in Europe, your ideal apartment is like this big, vast, empty space with a chair in the middle, and you holding
and there
an
would
iPad.
Just be like one, I don't know, like G4 iMac, like on a pedestal with a spotlight above it. And Steve Jobs comes to me whenever I have like a, it's like in a Foundation, but I have a Jobsian crisis, and then in my life every once in a while Steve Jobs appears and gives me a clue of what to do. I like this new life I'm going to have.
Right. And he'll just refer you to Woz.
I wonder if that's happening at Apple, actually. If secretly Steve Jobs was, like, frozen and made some recordings or whatever. Every once in a while, they go into a room and Steve Jobs' hologram appears. Ah, by now, Microsoft should have done the following.
All right. That was an interesting mental exercise. And at least we can't be as wrong as we've been in the past. So, that's good.
Hilarious if we get people right again. No, that's not what you want.
Right.
Ah, darn it. Messed up again.
Wrong.
I do kind of like that idea of maybe not a missile system, but actually it had occurred to me to go big and explore a big mainframe or something.
Because Earl might have actually picked that instead of 128. We should ask him next episode, because I could see him have maybe picked a PDP system or something.
Yeah. Okay, so I will move on to listener feedback. There's a fair amount of this. So let's see. So Brian wrote on Facebook about the last episode, where we talked about recently obsolete tech and had a number of comments about, you know, mostly networking issues that came up. It's maybe worth looking at his Facebook post, but of course, you know, if you're hearing this about at the time we release it or later, it'll be hard to find the Facebook post because Facebook is terrible. But come join us on our Facebook group. At any rate. But yeah, so what Brian wrote to say is that, you know, older tech typically only supports wireless A, B with WEP security. And another option besides the second router that we talked about was some routers have a guest network that you can use to set up lower security on, and that'll sort of help isolate your modern equipment from your vintage stuff. But then he went on to talk a little bit about how he wanted to share a network-attached storage device so they could get disk images and information back and forth. And that's, of course, you can't put that on the guest network, and you can't put that, you can't put your old network, old computers on the internet, and very complicated to get it, the dance to make it work. And he suggested actually using parental controls as a way to help isolate your system from, you know, the evils of the internet. I don't know.
Well, that's an interesting
how well that
idea.
Works. Yeah.
That hadn't even occurred to me.
Yeah. I pass right over those and all the preferences and stuff, but, and you know, first I frown at them and then I pass over them. but this seems like a pretty good use of them. And also you have to worry about things like networks often, you know, at least old networks don't often allow for the long file names that they, you know, that they can use in slightly more modern DOS-based systems. So you wind up having to use like 8.3 file names for everything. So anyway.
I love browsing stuff where suddenly all the files end with tildes. Just like,
Not good. But anyway, yeah, so that's interesting. Brian actually wrote a little bit more in detail there if you want to read it, but thanks for that. And something I was going to mention, I think last time but forgotten, you know, the time before and whatever, but back on RCR 182, I think was the one where we talked about capacitors and the need to replace them, and Beebs pointed out that not everybody has a deep understanding of what capacitors are. And I did just want to point out, none of, we also don't. So, I mean, like, the question is a perfectly reasonable one. I think I may have said it in kind of a way that made it sound like it wasn't a reasonable question, but it definitely was. I mean, like, and you could tell from our answers that we barely knew what we were talking about anyway.
Well, I think it was perfectly clear, the capacitor.
Yeah. I think I could take a stab at this, and then later Quinn could write in and laugh at me. Because did we not talk about what capacitors do?
The thing I wanted to just sort of highlight was that the question was good. I mean, the question was sensible.
Right.
It's only just that
they were asking the wrong people.
We didn't answer it well. Our answers were unsensible.
Right. Okay. How about this? When people have asked me, I've always said capacitors are bathtubs for electricity. So that's like the mental metaphor I've always used. So imagine if you've got, your electricity is water, and you can only send it in big buckets. So it's big AC bursts, bloosh, bloosh, bloosh. But what you need is a steady, constant stream. Bathtub is perfect for that. You throw your buckets in the bathtub, you have a little hole in the bottom. So you throw the water in big splashes, but it comes out as a steady stream. That's what capacitors do often when you're changing or regulating stuff. Or think of it, instead of it being a bathtub, like a bathtub without a drain, but the big trap door. So when you need a capacitor to store up electricity and then let it out in a burst, like, so you've got a camera that with a flash and you've only got a little battery that gives you a little glug of power. So like a hose filling a bathtub, you wait for the bathtub to fill and then it just drops out the bottom and gives you a whole bunch of power at once. So that's not a bathtub so much as a trap door, but whatever. But I think of capacitors as doing that sort of thing. Going from glugs to streams and going from streams to big bursts and that sort of thing. So capacitors are bathtubs for electricity. So Quinn can write in later and say how wrong I am. But yeah. for like most of my life, I've thought of capacitors as bathtubs.
Yeah, and that reminds me of what one of my brothers used to do. He used to trickle charge up capacitors, and then someone unsuspecting, he'd just toss it over to them and yell, catch.
Marvelous.
He's got a charming sense of humor.
Yeah, the bathtub thing is sort of interesting. At first, I had no idea where you were going with this. I'm like, you know, well, if you just, isn't it just going to splash over the top at the same rate that it went in? But you have to have a hole in the bottom for this to be sensible.
Yes, because then it's not a bathtub. It's just a bucket.
Right. Well, you can have a bucket with a hole in the bottom.
Dear Liza.
There's songs about that.
Actually, yeah, there's I think a, I don't know if it's famous or not, but I know that as part of a, like, my undergraduate I think it was physics work. I had to model the chaotic behavior of a Ferris wheel that had buckets all around it, but they all had holes in them, and then they're in the rain.
Oh my goodness.
Anyway, whatever. Turns out it acts, you know, sensitive dependence on initial conditions and all that. But, okay, whatever.
Solving real world problems.
Yeah, okay.
Or writing Beverly Hills Cop 3. One of the two.
So, anyway, the point was, didn't mean to mock the question. The question was perfectly reasonable.
No, good question.
So, okay, so let's see. Tony on Facebook wrote to point out that there's a forum for Acorn computers, Acorn and BBC microcomputers at star.org.uk. I was not familiar with this, but if you are like a person who is interested in the Acorn computers, this is a forum you can go to.
We should point out that it's not star.org. It's star. Like S-T-A-R-D-O-T, then the period, then the O-R-G.
Yes.
Nothing like throwing the word dot in something like this.
That's, I was just reading it. Of course, I didn't even notice that.
Maybe I think of it because Rachel and I today were looking at outdoor furniture stuff. And we went to a place called Dot. So the name of the furniture company is Dot. And its website is something like dot-furniture.com. So it's like, well, go to dot-furniture. Well, but the first dot isn't a dot. It's, I was like, so where's the car? I'm like, well, this is just silly. So.
We'll buy it from somewhere else.
Let's see. So also on Facebook, Bill wrote to point out that Call Apple has released an enhanced edition of Graphically Speaking, which is a book written by Mark Pelzarski, who he wrote a column for Soft Talk magazine. This is an Apple magazine. And the column was called Graphically Speaking, and it was just sort of about like how you do graphical stuff on the Apple II. Mark Pelzarski basically started Penguin Software and is responsible for The Graphics Magician, which is something that I think made it to a couple of different platforms, and they have some adventure games and things like that. And he will be speaking at Kansas Fest, so that was probably the motivation for Call Apple to release the enhanced edition of this book. But anyway, so I think that's interesting, and if you happen to be going to Kansas Fest, you can get this and have it signed, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. One of the nice things about the version of this book is Call Apple's done a real service in making a spiral bound version of it available. So there's a paperback or hardback, but you can get it in spiral bound. If you're not going to have the ebook version for something like a reference thing, spiral bound is such a better way to do it. I wish more things came out that way. So well done them.
Yeah, they introduced that with the DOS 4.1 manual. That I got the hardcover copy, and yeah, it doesn't help much when you're using it as a reference in front of the computer, and quite a few people made that comment, and they came back and said, "Oh, we could put a spiral bound option in there." And it's like, "Oh yeah, gee, thanks guys." But a spiral bound reference like that would be excellent.
Cool. Yeah. Just thinking back to the Apple II, it's got this. You know, if it's an Apple II that you're working on, it's got this nice sort of shelf already. You know, that you can just plop the book on, and these sort of half size books are pretty much perfect for that. So all the actual Apple II manuals were spiral bound, at least after the very first set. I'm pretty sure that the Soft Talk, the original, the real, you know, 80s one, was whatever it is, like plastic comb bound. So yeah, it's still flopped open.
I'm sure that my original Graphically Speaking is a comb bound manual.
Let's see, James wrote over email to point out, I think maybe it was the last time we were talking about the ceramic CPUs, and James wrote to point out that if you have a TI-99/4A, you might have a nice ceramic CPU in it, because lots of them did. Of course, you know, if you take it out, then you have a CPU and a non-working TI-99/4A.
But, right.
And this is the point where you put in the little jab about, well, what's the difference and all that, but...
Making the world a better place.
Speaking of it.
Actually, a TI-99, I don't know if it was the 4A or a previous one, was the first actual computer I ever touched and used.
Oh,
really? That sounds terrible when I say it that way. But it was in the public library. And then we got to like turn it on, and whatever I say sounds terrible right now.
Did you steal it?
I touched
CPU?
It, used it, turned it on. What's going on here? Anyway, it was fun.
So, Paul, about those parental controls.
Right. I never really... I didn't use the TI-99 very much. I did have one friend who had one, but I didn't... Maybe I didn't hang out with that person very much.
Was it because of the TI-99/4A? Because that's rude.
Well, it's like a correlating life choice, you know. But I think they're just fine. They're, you know, whatever, they're 16-hole bit computers, right? Ahead of their time. Okay, let's see. Speaking of TI-99/4A, Blake, a fan of the TI-99/4A, wrote on Twitter about a No Man's Sky. I don't think we talked about this before, but No Man's Sky came up a couple times ago, and Blake had pointed out that he had a blog post on the Byteseller in late 2016 about Rescue on Fractalus on the Apple II, which is kind of has a similar kind of like world generation capability in it. So check that out. That's pretty cool. Mm.
Yeah, if you think about it, No Man's Sky is kind of like Rescue on Fractalus as done by Kai's Power Tools. So it just has that kind of look to it. So yeah, cool.
And then the last one I'll mention is that Matt on Twitter wrote about regarding the VidHD that we talked about, this Apple II HDMI outputter. There's a similar device for the ZX Spectrum called the ZX HD, and there's a link there. I haven't looked at it super carefully, but it seems to be at least partially based on a Raspberry Pi Zero. If you are a ZX Spectrum person, then check this out.
I'm not, but I would have been willing to be a ZX Spectrum person. I've got a soft spot for that computer.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep meaning to attempt to become a ZX Spectrum person in the future, but...
All those lovely cassettes.
And that palette. Just appeals to me greatly. Palette.
And that color, that amazing, just aggressive color palette.
All right. And now I think we can turn to our list of items of interest in news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
I do.
You do?
Oh, I do. It's been 50 years since America put people on the moon, supposedly. Whatever. So the Apollo Mission Control Room thingy has, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, somebody was trying to raise, it was either $5 million or $50 million. I'm going to guess $5 million. Why not? To get it all working again. I think we even talked about it ages ago. And it got done, and it's reopened. So it's open to the public, so you can go and walk around the Apollo Mission Control Room. What they've done is bring it back to as close as they can, like, that exact moment. So the things that are shown on the screen are what would have been on the screen. Like, if you walk in and today's the day you're landing on the moon, everything is exactly where it was in, like, photographs. Like, documents being laid about, ashtrays set about, all of that. They say the only thing is missing is, like, the incredible amount of cigarette smoke in the air. That's not there. But everything else, they've tried to be as accurate as possible. This looks amazing. I think this would be a really, really cool thing to tour. So it's open to the public. It's open right now. So it's at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. And... just, like, how cool is that? Just, like, amazing. So we're going to have a link to the NASA site, nasa.gov. And yes, I say NASA, even though the A's stand for aeronautical and agencies, because there's not a rule where what they stand for, just saying, yes. But whatever. So go to nasa.gov. You can read about the mission control reopening. We'll also have a link to... a blog post, which is also, I think, links itself to an audio podcast I haven't listened to, just about the process of restoring it and what went involved. And there's a whole interview with somebody named Sandra Tetley about, like, what was involved in this and how did they get the info. And it's just, like, it's all just incredibly fascinating, like, because this is, like, an iconic room with iconic computers, and you can step into it as if it's 1969. Like, very, very, very neat. So that's one thing. And then related to that, it's not only been 50 years since people landed on the moon, it's also been 50 years since the invention of Moonlander, the game, and which is, like, amazing. In 1969, apparently, a high school student created the first version of, game simulator of moon landing, which means Moonlander is essentially a 50-year-old genre. Benj Edwards has written a very, very cool write-up about the history and evolution of Lunar Lander games over on PCMag.com, so we'll have a link to that as well. And it is a great article, so highly recommend it. I'm all excited about moon stuff. The moon is very cool.
Mm. Yeah, I also threw in an extra link there for you, Carrington. Quinn's Project Egress, where she participated with Adam Savage, Mythbusters fame, where they were recreating the Apollo hatch. It was being done as an art project, so it didn't need to have the engineering specifications up to space travel. But yes, Quinn turned one of the pieces for the door hatch control. And if you just go to Twitter or thereabout and do hashtag Project Egress, you'll find all the other makers and artists that were producing pieces for the hatch for Project Egress. It's a fun stroll through different manufacturing techniques to recreate the hatch. And of course, there's a link to Quinn's YouTube.
It's wild.
It is completely wild. Yeah. Yeah. And I knew she was working on, well, I saw on YouTube and Twitter, she was working on some part for something really cool that was secret. And then when I found out what it was, I was like, well, this is even cooler than I had imagined. What an amazing project. Like, tons of people involved. Yeah, you're right. It's not supposed to be like a space ready hatch. I think they're calling it an artistic replica of it. I was worried at first with like a whole bunch of people all making parts. What are the odds this goes together? We'll see. Well, it's the channel again.
They've got the engineering diagrams to work from. And I know that in Quinn's that she was pretty stoked in a few spots to get the tolerances spot on. But I don't know about some of the others that were doing some acrylic work for reproducing the glass in the hatch. There were some doing castings, so it'll be interesting to sort of see. I've got a whole list of blogs and YouTube videos to go through. Just want to sort of see how they go. And I would love to see them with all the parts spread out, sort of going, what goes here?
Yeah.
It doesn't fit.
Right. Or, we're done. What is this part?
Yeah. Who made the leftover? Houston, we have a problem.
One other thing. So I also tacked on a link at the end. Because it turns out that the MIT Museum, here in Cambridge, is doing something called Moonshots, which is a part of the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the first humans landing on the moon. And there's going to be a panel. So the Apollo Guidance Computer Restoration Team has sent participants Mike Stewart, Mark Verdiel, Ken Sheriff, Carl Klontsch, and Jimmy Loke to talk about this, basically. You can register for it. I would totally go, but I will be in Kansas City. So it's July 20th. 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. So if you happen to be like nearby Boston and interested in this, then and I get this edited in time for you to have heard this in time, go to that.
Very cool. A little bit of trivia. People may not know, but most of the movie Capricorn 1 was actually shot on the moon.
Fantastic.
Believe it or not.
All right, let's move on. Jack, you have a copy protection related thing.
Yeah. So. Now and then, copy protection comes up in our discussions. We talk about things about various stuff that was going on. And there's a nice video on YouTube. I found this on Hackaday. But it's a YouTube video that is entitled Dungeon Master Clever Floppy Disk Anti-Piracy on the Modern Vintage Gamer channel. And it's nice. It's about a 15-minute walkthrough of how copy protection was done in general and specifically for this game, Dungeon Master, which was a big hit on the Amiga and maybe the Atari ST. I don't know where else it was. But it's a nice sort of walkthrough of technology aspects, tracks and sectors and things. And also it goes into some ideas about that like some games have had systems where if the copy protection is found to have been broken, if the game determines that this is a pirated copy, to not fail immediately, but to let the player go along, maybe play the game for a couple hours before things start to go haywire.
So evil.
Which is really nice. It's a nice idea from the developer's standpoint, because it means that people might think, oh, great, I cracked the game. I'll distribute it widely. And then the cracked game turns out to fail in strange ways for everyone who's got the copy of it.
Of course, also, it can start a rumor that, oh, that game kind of sucks. It's really buggy.
Yeah, true.
True. He did. I saw in there, he mentioned at least one game, I think it was a PlayStation 1 game called Spyro, this dragon mm-hmm. thing, where apparently if you got a pirated copy of that, after a while, it would actually, a character in the game would tell you, hey, it looks like you're playing a pirated copy. Things might get strange from here on out. And apparently you can play through the game, but things get super annoying and difficult. So there you don't think it's a mm-hmm. bug. You understand that it's, because it actually tells you, gotcha.
And didn't Prince of Persia have something like that?
I think so.
Yeah. I have a vague memory.
I mean,
most of my memories are vague.
I think you might be right. But yeah, we had the source code of that. And I looked through it probably at some point back in the distant past. Do not remember anymore. One thing I do remember, I think there were a couple of like sort of Easter eggs that were available on boot up. And one of them was if you hit a certain key, then it would start making your disk drive make a sort of rattling noise that you could control with the paddle or with the joystick. So it would be sort of like a motorcycle. You know, it could go. Anyway. That's what I learned by looking at the source code of Prince of Persia, I believe.
Cool.
Okay, Michael, tell us about VCF West.
Well, VCF West has what I think one of the most interesting draw cards to a vintage computer show that I've seen in a long time. They say that they are going to have 10, possibly more, Apple I computers, and their current owners will be joining in with some original Apple employees in a panel to discuss these computers, why they were purchased, how they were used, and what they plan to do with them in the future. So just having 10 Apple I computers in one place, you know, it just sort of blows my mind. And I've been sort of like following some emails and some other threads on this, and a few people have also suggested including a range of the Apple I clone boards and other ones. So there may even be everything from the original Apple I through to component identical replicas, and I would love to see Vince Briel's one there as well, his Apple I emulator, hardware emulator. But just to be there to see this many Apple I computers, I certainly hope the conference has their insurance up to date.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All the different ways that these computers could be presented, because you know, they were bought effectively as bare boards with the components either on it or whatever, but to sort of see how these owners have set them up, how they've been presented, just to sort of see all of these machines in one place at the one time, I think it'd be great. So if anyone's sort of trying to figure out what to do, August 3 to 4th this year, head on to the Computer History Museum.
What am I going
to
do? I'm going to organize a heist.
That's right. Well, and so I guess this means you have about a month. If you want to write, you know, some sort of like networked Star Trek game or something, so that everybody can sit at their own Apple I, whatever.
And the fun part about that is your ship might like actually explode. Well, my computer's down as yeah. things burst and you're out of the network. So adds a level of excitement to the game.
I've taken a hit with smoke's trailing out.
All right, let's see. I have the next one, and as it happens, we're just talking about this. So on Jordan Mechner's site, he's got a 30th anniversary note to Prince of Persia fans, where he points out that 30 years ago, on the day that he posted it, June 27th, he was crunching on a 6-week deadline to finish Prince of Persia by mid-July to ship in September. And we might have... I'm sure we probably did talk about the fact that part of the reason he knows this is because he kept pretty sophisticated, pretty detailed journals of the development process. Just like, you know, I think also just kind of like of his life, but also, you know, like what happened in the developing of Prince of Persia. And so at some point, some years ago, he made those available as kind of like a book. He sold that as a book. And this, what he's going to do this year, he's aiming to have printed hardcover editions of this available by PAX East in spring 2020. This is going to be sort of like an enhanced collector's edition of The Making of Prince of Persia. And so he's working with various people to try to get as much kind of extra content and stuff in there as possible. So I think that's kind of cool. Basically, I'm just announcing the news.
Mm. I love the photo in there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a pretty cool photo of him sitting at
When I first saw it, I thought, what are you holding a candle for? But I think it might actually just be a styrofoam cup.
And it looks to me like he's got the like rotoscoped figure frames up on the wall. He's got an Amdek Color One monitor, which is my favorite monitor since that is the one I had as well. Anyway, yes. So check that out if you're interested. I think it's interesting just from a looking at game development notes perspective as well. I think he also has he actually did release both development notes for Karateka and for Prince of Persia. And I think this may only relate to the Prince of Persia ones. Mentioning also just as a listener feedback, Klaus wrote, when this was mentioned on the Facebook page by Tony, and Klaus mentioned in a comment to that we talked about the Prince of Persia source code on about episode 24 or so. You might recall that Klaus was the one who was starting from the beginning. So he can fill us in on all our old references. All right. Carrington, you have the next thing.
I know so much less than I think I know. It's unbelievable how much I'm wrong about, and so every day I learn new stuff. And this time I learn things because it's the 50th anniversary of Frog design. I know Frog. A lot of people who listen to this will know Frog as the people who designed the Apple stuff for quite a while, the Snow White line of things, like the 2C and what else is there? The Macintosh 2C. So like all the 2Cs, the 2Ci, the 2CX, and like just so many things. And I know the Snow White line, but I always thought, foolishly, it was called the Snow White line because it was like the white stuff. There was the beige stuff, and then we went into the white stuff, and so therefore it's Snow White. Nope, completely nothing to do with that. This is probably not news to anybody but me, but it turns out Frog Design just had its 50th anniversary, and so they had a big celebration about it. We'll have links to that. But there was a request for proposal, an RFP, which is a thing happens a lot if you're a big company and you want people to make. I've had to deal with them with websites and stuff. But people, if you want to design a new car or whatever, the car manufacturer will send out an RFP and say, give us your pitch. Why should you be the design company for this? Do a whole bunch of free work, basically, and tell us your ideas. So Frog Design got the request for proposal from Steve Jobs, from Apple, looking for Snow White items. Just Snow White's just the code name of the stuff, nothing to do with the whiteness, and there was seven different items, or actually eight, named after the dwarves. So they're looking for Doc, Sneezy, Happy, Bashful, Sleepy, Grumpy, Dopey, and Flower. Flower, I think, was the skunk from Bambi, but whatever. So Doc was, they want a proposal for a design for the next generation of the Lisa. Sneezy, Happy, like Happy was the Mac next generation, Bashful was a book computer, like give us a design for a book, in quotes, computer, like a PowerBook type thing. Sleepy was a mouse, Grumpy was a printer. All this was completely news to me. I didn't know any of this. I just thought it was Snow White because they were white. I know so very little. It's crazy you guys let me on this podcast. So we're going to have a link to a Verge article about this, like the specifically the 50th anniversary of Frog Design, but particularly this particular request for proposal came from Apple, said, here's the seven things or eight things we want designs for. And it ended with a little picture of the evil queen. And saying, like, who's the fairest of them all, which is basically asking a bunch of design companies to say, give us your pitch, your initial ideas, some design mock-ups, some models or whatever. And Frog won the design, not competition, but the request. And so they got the budget and they worked with Apple and to design all these things. But this was actually the first time I found out what Snow White really meant. I can't believe it's all these years later, and this was news to me. So we'll have a link to that, the Verge article, which is really good. And we'll also have a link over to over at the frogdesign.com site itself. They have a gallery called Frog 50, the Decades of Design, where there's not a lot of info there, but there's like one photo each from a bunch of different stuff, from televisions, from computers, from precursors to the Walkman, motorcycle things, all of that. And you can hover over the one photo and then it tells you, oh, this was the Sun Microsystems Spark Station and what was the goal for that design. Because they're like, a very famous design house. So you'll probably recognize the vast majority of the things here, even in their like initial prototypes. You can see the products that came out of them. So all very interesting stuff from a design standpoint. But I think the main story here is it's crazy how little Carrington knows.
I did not know this either, but... about
really?
Snow
I just assumed
name.
Everybody must. I'm like, what the heck? So, I assumed white, Snow White, they're the whiter products, so that's what it's from. This has never occurred to me before, so...
Oh, for shame, Carrington.
I didn't even know those products were called Snow White design. I had no idea.
I'd heard the Snow White word before, but I just, you know, made a bunch of assumptions and, you know, why check my work? Well, welcome to my privilege. There is in the Verge article, photos of, because they had like an open house and you could see the stuff at Frog Design. And so there's a lot of wooden models. Like that seems what they do is they make a model of the computer or whatever out of wood and it's painted up and it looks like plastic, but it's actually carved out of wood. And there is a Lisa prototype photo here that I hadn't seen, a couple photos, and it's a Lisa all-in-one computer with a full page, a vertical display, so that the monitor is as if it's 8x11 page stacked vertically.
Portrait monitor.
And it's got this little slit in the front that's supposed to take two floppy drives, and it's freaking gorgeous. Mm-hmm. If this had been the Lisa, I would have been a Lisa user. This is just unbelievably beautiful. It looks like the perfect computer from the Mac 2CX, 2CI era, but just even better. And it was a Lisa, and it's just a prototype, and it's unbelievably beautiful. So that might be a good reason on its own to go to this, but a lot of really cool photos.
A lot of it looks like, you know, you're walking into a prop display for a sci-fi movie. Some of those other bits and pieces are just great. And that they also do design consulting and whatnot. And one of my favorite takeaways from this is that Polk had Frog do a study on its product lines across three different brands to see how they could better take on Beats headphones before it was purchased by Apple. Frog's conclusion, most consumers care less about audio quality than they do about how their headphones look.
Yep, that sounds about right.
I think that sums it up. But there's some beautiful stuff in there.
I also did not know that Frog had anything to do with the Next, but apparently the Next Cube is theirs too.
Mm-hmm.
The special coconut remarkable. Breaking corner.
Yeah, it's a remarkable design house and have done a lot of lovely things that have been things that I have enjoyed and coveted. And so Frog Design is I'm a fan of them, but I had no idea about the Snow White thing. But it's amazing. With Johnny Ive leaving Apple, which is like a thing, and his design sense being like probably the most important designer of modern times, like crazy. But it's important to remember that like Frog Design and those people and other people at Apple also like informed a lot of Apple's design stuff, especially with Frog. I think up till the late 80s, it was Frog. So really cool stuff from the heyday of Apple, all the vintage stuff.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm going to have to look through those photos later. Okay, I think that's all for the news here. I will quickly mention the upcoming shows that I think we'll continue to have listed in the show notes. They haven't changed since last time, but anyway, Kansas Fest, Kansas City, Missouri, is coming up July 16th to 21st. VCF West in Mountain View, California, August 3rd to 4th, where there will be a heist. There won't be a heist.
We will be suspects if there is.
That's right. The Fujiyama 2019 Atari show in Lingenfeld, Germany, August 26th to September 4th, and the Tandy Assembly 2019 in Springfield, Ohio, September 27th to 29th. And if there are things that we should be mentioning here, tell us what they are, because we may not just happen across them. So until then, we're going to keep saying these same four.
Fujiyama one, none of us knew it even existed, and it existed for years until we stumbled upon it. Right. So I'm sure there's others out there. Let us know.
And then we spent like six episodes in a row talking about it.
We're excited to find out new ones.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, and now a word from our sponsor.
This is where America's peace of mind begins. Around the clock, radar's electronic eyes watch the skies and report what they see to SAGE, Defense System of the United States Air Force. Here is a SAGE center on 24-hour alert. At its heart is a computer developed by a research team from MIT and IBM working with the Air Force. The SAGE computer speeds the information for decisions by man in our missile age. Every scheduled flight across American frontiers is recorded ahead of time on IBM punch cards, then fed into the SAGE computer. Now the computer can draw a picture of what is supposed to be in the sky at any moment. It continually compares this expected picture with the real picture as seen by radar. If a flying object does not belong, it appears on this viewing screen. There's one now at the right of the screen. They call it a blip, unknown flying object. Friend or foe? Within seconds, the Air Force will know. The officer fires a light gun at the target blip. This tells the computer to track the object. At the launching site, a long-range Bomark missile is readied for firing. Now they ask the computer to calculate an intercept point. X marks the spot where the Bomark missile would meet the moving target if fired immediately. The officer in charge makes the final decision. Fire. At the moment of launching, the Bomark missile receives instructions from the IBM computer. As the missile screams toward target, radar keeps on tracking. With electronic control, the computer automatically adjusts the missile to meet any change in the target flight. There is no escape. Intercept. This was a test. One of many successful tests of the Sage Bomark security team. Our new system of air defense. To be ready for the worst, so that the worst will never happen, America is now armed with instant electronic reflexes. The Sage computer, made by IBM, is another example of the vast new powers that man can achieve through the creative use of his mind. Strength for national defense. Speed for informed decisions. Service for a growing America. This is IBM, freeing man's mind to shape the future.
And we're back. I am the host, and I am responsible for the host's retro computing gift idea. And nevertheless, I'm going to hand it over to Michael, who has the suggestion for this one. Do you want to just tell us what it is from the beginning?
Okay. Well, this is a selection of prints that were commissioned by the National Museum of Computing and Bletchley Park. Now, what we have is limited number prints, 500, I believe. There's Colossus, the bomb, there's the Enigma, there's Lorenz, there's a picture of the mansion itself, and these are very, very nice prints. And the story behind it is that I had planned to go to Kansas Fest this year, but due to health reasons, I'm not traveling this year, and I intended to basically do it as a lap of the planet. So after Kansas Fest, I was going to fly off to Dublin in Ireland, and then off to London, and then catch the train up to Bletchley Park. And I was going to get the one for Colossus and the bomb, and they were going to be my souvenirs of my 2019 trip. But I'm going to have a look to see if I can get these shipped to me. As it says, there's only 500 available worldwide, so I'm assuming that there is some shipping to go on top of the £70 per print, and probably extra for framing. Actually, no, that's the framed price. They're cheap. I think they're about £35-40 for just the paper stock.
They look really cool. This Colossus one, at least.
Yeah.
Very nice.
I'd want Colossus from the movie, like the voice of world control.
This is the Colossus. Where programmable computing sort of really began. You could almost say that the hut, which is a lovely euphemistic term for the two-story building that they actually were going to install the Colossus into, was the first purpose-built computer building. It basically was built, designed and built for the Colossus computer, for its cracking of the German fish codes, the Lorenz and whatnot. And so not only was it the birth of programmable computers, it was the birth of the false floor and all the other things which we know and love in computer rooms today.
Good point. Very cool.
I really like these now that I'm kind of like flipping through the art. Mm-hmm. The art
They're
style
beautiful.
Is great.
Beautiful.
Yes, you two should just pop over. Jack could just have a weekend over there.
Quick trip.
A field trip, yes, just pop over, just a day trip, maybe a weekend.
They're unable to accept requests for specific numbered prints, so they anticipated the geek impulse to say.
I always tried to get 007 for my print numbers, but not very successful at times.
Right. Okay, so once you're done buying those prints, we have some things on eBay that we can point you to that you could look and see if they're interesting. At least you don't need to buy them, but let's see what we have. Carrington, you have the first nice little pile.
100. I went full Paul. I picked 100 things. I don't know. We have the notes up longer this time, and so I just keep throwing things in. So my first choice is a lovely example of frog design type stuff. To throw back to that, it's the Apple 1200 dial-up modem. Do you need a modem now? No, you do not. But it's a lovely modem. So if you wanted a modem, not for use, but for just prettiness, this is beautiful. So it's from that design era where things are white and sculpted, and it's just lovely. And so it's just a 1200 baud modem. Totally useless, totally gorgeous, $70, sold to Paul. So that's the first one. Second item, an example of how Apple's design stuff informed other people's design. This is a CH Products. They make really good joysticks. This one I hadn't seen. It's the Mach 4 Plus ADB joystick for the Mac. And so it's got when I think of a CH joystick, there's a particular shape. It's like boxy, got a couple of square buttons. It'll have rectangular or square rectangular buttons and have like rectangular slidey things. There's a particular shape to it. Mm-hmm. So it's like a CH Products joystick that's just been extruded to give it a long chin for some reason. Hadn't seen this before. Really like it. And this is a person who knows how to make very nice photos for their eBay listings. Looks like a lovely piece of art.
I dig this. Javier.
Oh, is it really? Yeah. Oh, well, that's why it's so white. He's totally retro-ready the heck out of this thing. So that's why. So this is gorgeous, but probably brittle as heck. But it's beautiful. It's such a beautiful... I guess I just had never encountered this particular one before, but it has me coveting an ADB Mac or ADB Mac joystick for a Mac I don't even have. I just think it's beautiful.
Yeah, so I've seen these before, and I don't entirely understand it. There's a switch on the bottom that lets you switch between stick and mouse. So it is apparently also able to be used as a mouse, or maybe... It is a mouse that you can use as a joystick.
It seems two cables coming off it. So does the mouse flow through and this interrupts the ADB, so you only have the one ADB thing plugged in? I don't know how this works. I don't know this thing at all. I just like it. I think it's pretty.
Yeah, I don't know actually what those two cables are for. It looks like maybe one... Maybe it's not just for the Mac, but for a couple of different computers, and one goes to one computer and the other goes to the other.
Mm, there is a little a section of four dip switches on the bottom as well for mode selection. Mm, so yeah. Maybe you have to configure it things, but it's ADB, so it's only going to work with so many things.
Yeah, well, one of those cables is definitely not ADB.
Right.
That is a little serial thing. Ah.
But so the thing I have not understood about this is I don't know what that... So the whole thing looks like a pedal or something, or a duck, a unicorn duck.
Duck.
But
now I want it more.
Yeah. But I don't understand what the pedal part is for. Is it really just like a place to rest your wrist? Is it touch-sensitive somehow?
Know. No, I don't. I think it's just a hunk of plastic. It's just such a weird shape for a joystick. Mm. It really, but also it's appealing to me. Like, physically, it appeals to me. I don't understand it, but I kind of want it.
I think maybe it's that way so that you can more easily put the joystick flat on a desk.
Okay.
And use it without it tipping around, because you can kind of hold it down with your wrist.
Or your elbow.
Or your other hand. Yeah, your elbow. Your knee.
This has so many things on it. It's actually like one of those little things you give like 2-year-olds or whatever, or to play with.
Like adjustment knobs,
push these buttons and turn these knobs.
Stuff all over it just to try to play a game. Anyway, I really dig it. It's $83.
Yeah, probably open it up and find that all those extra sliders and dials and things aren't connected.
Right. Just seriously, there are two big rectangular buttons. There's a fire button on the top of a joystick that goes in, you know, whatever, two dimensions. There's two little adjustment wheels and then two other little slidey adjustment things. There's four
and
sliding
two big
adjustment
fire buttons
things.
On the side. Yep.
Four dip switches on the
in
back.
In addition to the adjustment stuff that's on the bottom, and then two cables coming out of it, and it's beautiful. It's a joystick for everybody.
That's right.
It's $82 and it can be yours.
At once.
And if this podcast gets edited in record time and less than 11 hours from now, it's live and you're listening, then you can have a chance to purchase my next two eBay auction choices, which are the 2GS for the servicing technician, their service training manuals. There's two of them available online. I don't know if these are rare or not. I hadn't come across them before. I don't know. But if you want to service your 2GS and you want to be a servicing technician, of course you do. There's two versions online, one with the software that comes with it and one without, both being sold by the same person. $112.50, weird number, for the buy it now for the one without the software, and $157.50 for the one with the software, both though with the make offer things.
Interesting.
Paul, do you have these already? Do you have them? Have you scanned them?
I don't have them. I have not scanned them. I don't think I've seen them, but I tend to kind of ignore 2GS stuff. Oh, wait. No, hold on. Actually, one of them is for the Apple IIe and Apple IIc Plus.
Oh, so it is. Look at that.
That's interesting.
I assumed it was the same thing because one has software and one doesn't.
No.
So the 2E and 2C Plus one is the $112.50. And I hadn't seen these before. I want somebody to have this and scan it.
Yeah.
I just don't want to drop the $112 myself. Paul needs this.
Yeah, it's possible. The $112.50 turns out to be 10% off of $125, which
is why
it gets to be that weird number. But
so you can't afford not to buy it, Paul.
That's right.
The next 10 hours and 44 minutes and 49 seconds, it's going to haunt you.
Yeah, look at how much you're saving.
Yeah.
So these are from November 1990. Which sounds like a recent year, but is still in the 2GS, 2C Plus range.
Mm-hmm. You need it, Paul. You need it. You also need my next choice, which is a Sage computer. Yes, it's back, folks, and it's on eBay. But
it's much smaller than I thought.
It's not the Sage we talked about before. So instead of being two floors, 2 tons, is instead a little tiny thing that looks like a dual disc. It's a Sage 2. I don't really know this thing, but it's a Sage 2 computer. Caught my eye. It's $1,300. Paul might be able to resist this one.
Yeah.
I don't think we've spoken about this before or chosen it before. I couldn't find anything about it. The one thing I did find was like a link to some other one of these being sold once before, but I don't really know about the Sage or the Sage 2. Presumably there was an original Sage, and this is unrelated to the missile computer. So do you guys know what this thing is?
Nope.
It's a CPM computer, according to the listing, but I don't know anything about it.
I don't know if I should say this, maybe I should, but my impression is this is being sold by Vintage Computer Museum, the seller, who often has these really kind of, you know, interesting, unique, you know, kind of oddball things that you don't see anywhere else. And they're often priced in the stratosphere. So
yeah. So it looks like this. I mean, the description says it's in a some sort of case, an Altos design case, ALTOS. So I don't know if that's like, so the Sage 2 didn't normally come in that case, or it did, or maybe the Sage 2 was a kit computer. Like I really don't know anything about this, but it says it in the description of the listing, it says it used the UCSD P system operating system. So I guess that's P code. And it's a CPM 68K computer.
Okay. So it's like, Pascal on the Apple II.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So Paul will buy that as well for $1,300. But this is the section of the podcast where we spend Paul's money. And the last thing I'm going to make Paul purchase with my missile computers pointed at Paul, force him to buy things. I've got design stuff on the mind, I guess. And so this is an interesting little thing. So it's €45, so a bit expensive, but it's an Apple logo printed on vellum. So you think, well, why would I spend $50 on an Apple logo? So this is almost certainly a print proof then. So it's from 1983. And usually this is what's done at a factory as a last stage printing before you start to like stamp it onto things. So this is, it might not be the last one, but it's no doubt a test print from a factory going into manufacture for the Apple II, I guess, if it's 1983 or who knows what. So they print it on vellum to test that your plates are okay. So it's in a little sheet saying it's from February 1983, 11th of February 1983, and it's a $50 little tiny square of vellum. So if you really like the Apple logo and you want to go into manufacture, this might be something you need.
That's pretty cool.
Yep.
Steve Jobs might have looked at this once.
And poo-pooed it. It's being slightly wrong.
Yeah. Very cool.
So those are my choices. I went full Paul and picked many things.
Excellent. Michael, you have the next set of multiple things.
Well, I restrained myself. So the first one which I've got is a 1982 Dungeons of Daggeroth for the Tandy Color Computer. So it's the game and manual. So if you're wanting some cartridge games from the good old days for your color computer, this one is up in Carrington land for $59.99.
Ooh. I'm also up in Carrington land.
Hey.
Yes.
What a coincidence.
And I had a Tandy Coco, but I never had this, but I did have cartridges.
Mm.
It looks kind of, it's kind of pretty. I mean, like, you know, it's very sort of big saturated colors. Looks, the box is
I just love that saturated color of the prints. And yeah, so. And then the other one is for to give a little bit of helping hand to your Amiga 500 or 2000. It's a accelerator. So it's built on a 68030 just to get some extra oomph out of your Amiga. So if you're looking for a retro accelerator for your retro computer, this is the one to get.
Perfect for my desert island.
I was going to say, I could see the desert island just over from my desert island that is running an Amiga might find this handy. Mm-hmm. So I might trade you some coconuts for it.
Awesome.
And Paul can open them up on his next cube.
Everything is perfect. Carrington will defend us.
No, I'm going to take you over. Taking all your coconuts.
Yes. Okay, let's see. So I put probably more in the show notes than I'll talk about, but the first one that caught my attention was another one of these kind of marvels of bad listings, or at least non-descriptive listings. There is a listing that says vintage computer, don't know if works. No is spelled N-O.
And, of course it is.
It's a $300 buy it now, or you can bid at $200.
Looking at the photos, I have a guess on whether or not it works.
Yeah, it is. But nevertheless, the photos still caught my attention because it is a PET 2001 with like the little chiclet keyboard and the cassette built in. So it's like one of these early ones. The keyboard is actually out, so it's on top of the case rather than under the case where it should be. The whole thing is kind of covered in dust. I can understand why the guy doesn't know if works, but...
well, because it's not plugged in.
That might be part of it.
Don't know if plugged in.
However, yeah, so the thing is that it struck me as not being super expensive for this thing that is pretty rare. Mm. Although it's $100 shipping, at least to me, and these things, I believe, are pretty heavy. So I'm also not sure if this person knows how pack... But at any rate,
well, they probably can pack as well as they can spill.
Yeah.
And Jack's right. There's no apostrophe. It's not don't. It's daunt.
Daunt.
No. If works.
Daunt. No. Daunt. No.
Yes. So anyway, there's another auction for a PET 2001 that I just happened to come across that you can compare it to. So this one is. Buy it now at $400, so that's kind of a lot. Free local pickup, and probably that may actually be the only option in California. The one, if we don't know if works, is in Chicago. And so the pictures are, in general, much nicer on this other one.
I dropped the $400 on this one before I even haggled from the $300 down or whatever for the other one. Yeah, this is nicely presented. Mm-hmm. Unless he's plugged the monitor into another unit, it's working.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems very bright. It seems very clean. It has a bunch of manuals with it, a personal computer, PET user manual, and some reference cards and things. It seems that at least one of these photos is taken in selfie mode, so everything's reversed for some reason that I don't understand.
And also they've gone around the outside of it, like with... black, but very poorly done in paint, so it looks like it's got big chips out of the computer, but I think it's just how they blacked it out.
Yeah, the void is coming in to eat it or something.
But at least we don't know.
That's true.
We don't know.
It
It do work.
It do work, and it's also a very clean computer.
Yeah, it's very nice. I'm sure, you know, I wonder what the incriminating stuff was that was all around it when the photo was taken. But
that keyboard, though, man, I know it's super collectible, but that is not a keyboard you want to spend a lot of time on.
When did we give a discount if we gave him some Photoshop lessons?
Yeah, maybe. Well, and actually, the these keyboards have stickers on them, I believe, and they look in pretty good shape. Like, I think nobody likes this keyboard, and no one used this computer. So it's still looking pretty good.
Just interested in, because in that first shot that does show the keyboard in good condition, just the bezel of the monitor, it's a little bit funny looking. I haven't seen that happen to a monitor before. It doesn't seem to be dirt.
Yeah,
it's almost like a bit of a hint, almost like a hint of rust in that lower left-hand corner of the monitor.
Yeah, it looks kind of like corrosion.
Yeah. Because these are metal, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, they weigh 1,000,000 pounds.
Yeah.
They weigh almost as much as a sage.
But so one thing that's kind of interesting is that this you know, the new nice one that we were just talking about, it is a PET series 2001 series personal computer. And if we go back and look at the other one, it is a PET 2001 series professional computer. So...
Oh,
I didn't know there were
professional
two.
Dirt.
But apparently there's a difference between the personal and professional. The only thing that I see is that the professional one is like missing a couple of keys and is dirty, but
yeah, I don't know the difference between them.
No.
Anyway, I thought that was somewhat interesting.
Okay,
so the next thing I have is I'm actually more commenting on auctions, I suppose, but so is the Radio Shack TRS-80 Model 4P. Looks like it's actually in pretty decent condition. It has a manual with it, and it starts up. The screen looks bright, and it starts up with the message that, you know, says in many languages, can't start. But the thing about this, and I think this might be a property of the 4P itself, but it really looks like a roasted marshmallow. It does. It has turned.
Michael must love it.
It's unbelievably yellow. I mean, it's orange, actually. It's, yeah, some of these, and of course the case, the top part of the cover has yellowed at a different rate. It's just amazing, though. I have seen them turn orange like this before, but not quite to this degree.
I wonder if it's been a room with someone smoking or something. Like, it's extremely, like, it looks almost like coated.
Yeah. Yeah, you wipe your finger on it, like, oh no, change my mind.
I think I'd be sitting this one out on the veranda for a while. I've bought stuff off eBay, and you open it up and you almost die from the liberated cigarette smell. But yeah, I think this is just gone orange. I don't think it's actual smoke, cigarette staining. It's too consistent to be cigarette smoke.
Yeah, and I mean, it does appear to be in, apart from the color, it's actually looks like it's a pretty good one. But
yeah. I know I don't really like retro brighting, but I think that if I wanted this one in my collection, I'd send it to Javier.
It's funny, one of these photos, they put it next to a bunch of cardboard boxes, and it's the same color as the boxes behind it.
Ah, camouflage.
All right, let's see. I don't know if I want to talk about this. Maybe I'll quickly mention it. I in the show notes I wrote, you know, that this is a NEC PC8300 that I might have already bought, but I don't know if I will. It's kind of interesting because it's... So this is in the same line that... I think it's Kyocera, I don't know how you pronounce it, that made the Model 100, and they made the PC8201A, I think. And the PC8300 is a little bit later than that, but it's the same kind of, like, sort of notebook computer, you know, somewhat large-ish LCD display. So, and the 8300 is, like, a little bit more powerful. But this one's nice because it comes with the box, comes with a bunch of manuals and things. And it's actually, it's got the box has a big thing on it that says SNK Portable Event Recorder. And it comes with an Apple II disc that is for the SNK portable event recording, I guess, that one does with this. Portable event recorder software programs for Apple from January 1990, it seems. So not even super, super old. And apparently this was actually used as sort of like experimental data, you know, collection in like psychology experiments and things.
Ooh, I'd like to see what's on those discs.
Yeah. I don't know I'm not sure if the data gets recorded onto the disk, but part of the reason I kind of wanted to get it is that I bet this software is something that may well be, you know, this might be the one that exists still.
Yeah, the it copy.
because, you know, certainly there are other PC-8300s out there, and maybe there were a few that were used for this particular thing. But I searched for SMK computer products a little bit just to see, and you know, I found a couple of references in old academic journals of people using this to do their experiments with it. But that's about it. So, and even if you were just looking for a PC-8300, though, it's kind of interesting. It's $140 buy it now, so it's not even outrageous.
Mm-hmm. And it's a super clean one.
Yeah. So the next one that I was going to talk about sold between earlier today and when we recorded. So I think other people realized that it was being listed for too little. But it's a vintage Apple multimedia kit, and I think it's kind of cool. It's called the Visual Almanac, and it has inside of it a floppy disk, a CD-ROM, and a Laserdisc. And you use this, so we must have talked about maybe a couple times, I forget what it's called, Kevin Savitz did this adventure game. You know what I'm talking about, Carrington?
Roller Coaster.
Yes, right. It was basically originally an Apple II controlling a video disc player over serial connection using a interface card. This is basically the same kind of thing, except it's for a Mac controlling a similar kind of Laserdisc player with this video disc, and it's, you know, it's an almanac kind of thing. But so it's an interesting sort of multimedia experiment, educational thing. And this one that you can't buy because someone else bought it is nice because it actually has the serial cable and all the pieces. I think ones that I've seen before, and in fact the video disc is even not open, but the serial cable tends to walk away from these things.
What's cool about this is I think the way these things always control a video disc player they send like a signal saying go to track 7 and play whatever. So it'd be interesting if, like, the way when you play certain albums backwards, you hear Satan or whatever. Are there certain movies you could put in and it would, like, line up for something really cool where it turns out, here's your secret message if you actually put in The Wizard of Oz instead of the video disc that comes with this? We'll never find out now because it's sold.
Yeah. That seems like a good way to use 4 years of your life. This one? Nope. This one? Nope. I also have a link to kind of like an exploration of what a description of what this is on domesday86.com.
Not Doomsday.
Yeah.
Domesday.
This is relating to the Domesday book or Doomsday book, right? I mean, like,
got it.
Might actually be pronounced Doomsday, but it looks like Domesday. So, next thing, running through things quickly here. There's a auction for something that says Apple II Music Micro Composer Software. Cassettes, 1979 deck card paddles. And if you look at it, it's basically a cardboard box, little foam insert thing. It has black paddles that are, I think they were originally Atari paddles, but they're sort of like the original ones that, semi-original ones, that second set. There's too many like little caveats here, but
right.
Very early Apple II paddles, wedge-shaped. And then there's some cassettes, Apple cassettes, and then there's this manual that says, where is it? Music Composer User's Guide, Micro Music Inc. And there's a interface card and stuff like that that come along with it. So there is, in fact, this interface card to, you know, some sort of digital audio system, you know, acquisition system or playing system, I guess, that comes with this manual. But the rest of the stuff is not related to that. What this actually is the accessories box that came with an Apple II computer originally. And it's actually a pretty valuable thing. So the paddles have their own little spot in the foam and all the original cassettes that come with it, the manual, the Apple tapes and stuff like that. It's just not advertised as being what it is.
Yeah, because I was wondering too, because I saw this and I thought, isn't most of this just Apple II stuff? And then there's also this binder. I was reading it right because I looked at it and I thought, this is a mix-up.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the person believes it's, you know, worth a lot anyway. So it's a $500 buy it now. And it's not an obvious buy at that price, but it is.
No.
It's in very good shape for what it is. And it's sort of a historically significant thing. And, you know, I think the music card itself is probably relatively rare. It's not an insane price for this, but it's high.
Yeah, but if you had an Apple II with everything, like, but this and this, put it back to be like a complete set, Maybe it's worth it. If you then go into flip or whatever, it's going to complete. You've got the box, got everything except this accessory kit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's It ain't cheap.
Mm.
So I thought that was an interesting little thing. And I think maybe the last thing I will mention is there is... I saw this and just thought it was kind of interesting. It is a Duck VT100 user guide. If you don't have a VT100, that's okay. The VT100 has just sort of like... I don't know, so deeply ingrained in our terminal culture at this point that I thought this was kind of like, it's sort of an iconic thing to have. Maybe a VT-102 is maybe a little bit more universal, but so I thought this would be kind of a neat thing to have. It's not super cheap. It's a $25 buy it now, but you could make an offer on it, and it's just sort of an interesting little artifact.
It's interesting because I also remember using the VT-102s, and it's a fun... little walk down memory lane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember often just having to say, this is the terminal that I'm using. You know, even though I was just using like a Mac terminal program or some such thing, I always had to tell it I was using a VT100.
Right, that's what everything wants to pretend to be.
Yes.
All right. Anyway, I think we made it through the eBay auctions. And so I guess we're actually already to the closing discussion point. And Carrington, you've written something there. What do you have to
say? Oh, sure. Got a couple of really quick things. Well, one really quick thing. Snacking on Software, which is Michael Packard's software stuff. He's got a new game for the Apple II, Dark Star Unhinged, coming out. It says it's coming in June, but it's really, really close to being released, I think. So it's and there are pre-orders now. It's just $20, and you get a signed copy. Love that there's new, you know, Apple II software that comes in baggies and stuff. So, and this game looks amazing. Mm-hmm. So it's available for purchase. The thing is, I don't know if this works with joystick or not. There's like, he wrote that incredible Alien Downpour game, which I can't play because it's like a keyboard thing. I don't think you can play it on joystick. You gotta do the keyboard thing, or it's like left and right and you press space to stop, and that just destroys me. But I don't know if definitively that's the only way you can play it. Like, that's the way I got to test it out when I was playing it at the Kansas Fest one time. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I can't play this. I need a joystick. So, but Dark Star Unhinged looks so good. So $20, can't go wrong. And I also put in the show notes, more fun than a poke in the eye, because I poked myself in the eye, and I have been squinting painfully this whole show. Oh, this hurts so much.
Man.
You did that purely so that you have this as a point of reference. So when someone says that's much fun as a poke in the eye, and you go, nah, poke in the eye is more fun.
Nope. Yep. Ah, I feel like I bruised my whole brain. It hurts a lot. I'm going to have to get a cool pirate patch, I think.
Yeah. Go see Madonna. She's got some spares.
I think the one thing that's kind of cool about this, you know, this snacking on software is that the author does tend to kind of, you know, as the games are being developed, give updates, you know, so you can sort of see like how the things are progressing. And I think actually just like today or something, there was a thread on Facebook about the keyboard controls, like what controls do you want? Do you want IJKM? Do you want WASD? The Apple II tended to use AZ and the arrow keys. And I think the ultimate conclusion was, you know, just let us pick them. But
Unbelievably, like the programming is crazy though. Like, this is all stuff that would have been massive, massive hits back in the day. Like, it's all assembler. The graphics are great, incredibly smooth animation, like just amazing action games. Like, it's the new Jubilee software or whatever of the time. Like, it just, I'm so impressed by the software. Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know about this one, but his first one was all hand coded assembler. So wasn't even doing it as a cross platform development. So don't know if he's continued doing that, but yeah,
it's got to be, because I looked at the
Alien Downpour.
The video
I loved
this.
Yeah, because it was such a magnus opus. It was beautiful, and to be a hand coded assembler as well.
Yeah, I'm sure this is like if you look at the video for this one, it's unbelievably smooth. It's basically a Defender type game.
Yeah.
But it's crazy, crazy fast action stuff.
Yeah, I think you pretty much the constraints are such that if you want to do something like that, doing it by hand is really like that's the way you can get it to fit and be fast.
Mm.
It's all done in BASIC.
I actually don't see any videos on here.
Oh, on his
video
page,
someplace, because I watched it.
Yeah, he does links to some YouTube videos in the Facebook posts, but yeah.
Yeah, if you just Google for it, you'd find it, because there's definitely a video up of gameplay, and it's remarkably impressive.
Cool.
And I think, I mean, I believe that if you want to just play the games, I don't think that costs anything. I think what costs something is getting the physical.
He charges for the physical media.
Yeah, but you get a signed copy, mm-hmm. You get a physical disc, baggy, it looks really cool, you're supporting development, and $20 is a completely reasonable request.
Mm. And he tests them on the Apple III, which is very cool.
Oh. So now I'm going to pay less.
anyway, all right.
I bought Alien Downpour from him on cassette, just because.
Cool.
Yeah, just because. I haven't actually tried loading it from the cassette, I just downloaded the disc image.
Jack, did you have anything you wanted to close with?
Oh, okay. No, not really. I've just been busy with other stuff.
What's your deal? That's the thing.
Is my deal
I have a different perspective on this from many of the other people participating because I just heard the last episode because I was editing it, fairly recently. So that was a callback to something you said, 2 weeks ago. But
I remember at the end of that. So what is my deal? Okay. I remember that too. I still don't know what my deal is.
Michael, what closing thoughts do you have?
Just to say that I've got 24 Sunburst software education titles on their way to me. I keep a standing search on these, and a lot of the times the Sunburst items on eBay and others are quite expensive, and because they normally come in a very large manual ring binder. And they also end up being quite expensive to ship. But I came across these from two sellers, and it's just the original documentation and the floppy disks. So I basically hit the buy it now on these, and they're just starting to... the second batch arrived in my US shipping address the other day, so... I've got some other items arriving there, so I'll get them all bundled up and on my way. And just a note here that copy protection works. So Sunburst software used various different types of copy protection. You can't trust those teachers. They'll buy one copy and make thousands and thousands of copies. But so I haven't gone and compared the list of all the titles with what's currently available, but what's currently available as cracked disk images, but anything in these that are new titles, because as I said, copy protection works, and it's a great way of keeping stuff out of the public archives. So I'll see how many of these are previously unpreserved and get those cracked and posted for other collectors.
Which is how you become a teacher in Australia.
It is. Yep.
Those educational titles,
some of them are gems and others are pieces of total fetid dingo kidneys.
But some of the stuff I've learned from the 4AM cracking things is it's unbelievable how much software was never cracked, because just not the interest in some business things, but mostly in educational things. But also how incredibly good a lot of educational software graphics were. I can't believe how good some stuff looked. Very, very impressive.
One of the things that I was thinking about was that a lot of people will have nostalgia for these too. They were never cracked, but these are the ones that they remember as a kid and they want to find them. So that makes it even sadder. Even if they weren't, fun, they still have
I don't know what's sadder, the kid wanting to, the adult wanting to reminisce these from when they were a kid, or the fact that people like us are preserving them.
But yeah, I think the other thing about these Sunburst, when you said Sunburst, it reminded me of, it's this and Mac, and there's a number of these, but and actually Sunburst and Mac are better about being sort of clear about which version is on the discs, that, because of course there are many versions of everything. But it's, sometimes I don't even want to think about it, because there are a huge number of titles, and to try to keep track of, like, all right, well, this one that I saw, this random disc that I see on eBay, is that one of the ones that we already have in this version or not?
And then the fact that Sunburst then broke out to do titles on other platforms.
Gonna have to start searching a little bit more to see if there's titles for other platforms that aren't on the Apple platform, which is what I'm interested in as far as preserving them goes. So the rabbit hole just got deeper.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I have a few, two or three Sunburst catalogs, and those are kind of useful because you can at least sort of like check off what they said they sold. But
yep.
But the version number stuff is really, I mean, you know, if you really do want to preserve everything, you need all the versions, and sometimes you just can't tell if it doesn't say anywhere on it on the disk or even when you start it what version it is.
Mm.
Yes, copy protection works.
It's like the worst Pokemon ever.
Okay, let's see. What closing thoughts do I have? I don't know. I feel still kind of discombobulated from traveling around, and I'm still not ready for Kansas Fest.
It's coming up really soon.
Yeah, 2 weeks from now, I'll be there. Anyway, we'll see if I actually wind up with anything to present or not. But
I hope that you do. I'm quite jealous. I'm sure it will be an amazing event.
Yeah, among us here, I think I'm the only one that's going to be there. Oh, and I think, so the, probably there is on this feed in some future time going to be, again, our annual multi-podcast, everybody sitting in a room and talking, playing some game that Kevin Savas comes up with.
Yeah.
So you can look forward to that probably one or two episodes in the future from now. And I guess that's basically it. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. And you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network, which you can find at a link in the show notes. And if you want, write a review on iTunes. We don't care either way. We'll read them.
We'll read them.
But we are not convinced that it does anything other than give us something to read. So, now that I've completely sort of stopped the flow all the way up until we're supposed to all talk together, until next time,
Retro Compute!